All right, it looks about time to start. I'm going to turn the presentation over to Mike Taylor of Vida Nuova.
Hey, thanks, Diane, and it's great that we've got so many people interested in doing this. I just want to give you a little bit of background as to where this has come from and what it's really a part of, because I think you saw that little disclaimer at the bottom. This is not to be considered a complete course. We've been teaching real estate to EPA for 4 years now, and I think we've trained over 800 EPA officials, and I know there are some folks on the phone, some state and federal regulators. And we did a 100-level course, which included some of this material that we're going to talk about today, and we've moved on now and are doing a 200-level course around the country, and we're doing it in Region 1 next week and then Region 9 in a month. And one of the things we noticed when we were in Philadelphia doing it was that a number of the people who took the course had not taken the 100-level course. And so we sort of asked people in the 200-level course to at least come understanding some of the real estate concepts, some of the finance concepts, so they can jump right into the case studies. And we actually have them act as the developer, and they get to look at pro formas and plans and environmental issues and see how they all work together. So as you can imagine, the two-day seminar, we kind of hit the gas and get going. So this is an opportunity for those of them that are going to be in those courses in Region 1 and 9, but I guess the way EPA does it is they open it up to anybody, and we're happy that you all have joined us, and we hope that maybe you'll be able to take one of our courses in the future and really get to apply some of this stuff, or as we find in many of our courses, many of you are already real estate speculators or at least own your own home, so you know, a lot of these concepts already apply, and we found that you know, we're all fellow travelers out there trying to make a better living for ourselves. So whatever your reason for joining us today, we're happy to have you. And the primary instructor will be Josh Carr, who's really the real estate finance expert. I'm more a brownfields expert, work a lot in public-private finance, helping to put cities and developers and private parties together. And Josh has spent at least some fair bit of his career working with Wall Street and the New York development community, helping them understand why they should invest their money in deals, and was part of Gamesmore Brookhill, one of the early brownfield developers, where he sort of cut his teeth on the whole brownfields market. So if you'll turn to slide 2, I'll start, and then I'm going to turn it over to Josh. As Diane said, what we're going to do is stop at 3 strategic times for questions, but if you have a question on a particular slide, do send that email to Diane so that we can stop. We are going to go over some simple in and of themselves, but if you've not, if you're not familiar with some of these concepts, the complexity can sort of build on you. So, you know, normally we do this classroom style, so when people have a question, we stop and answer it right away. We'll do the best we can today.
Mike, one thing I want to point out to everybody is in order to submit a question online, look at the top of your slides. There's a question mark. Just click on there and submit the type in your question at that point, and I'll be able to read it from here.
And Diane will interrupt us or whatever if it's something she feels we should talk about at that point or at the we're going to stop 3 times when I turn it over to Josh and at the end of the Sarasota example and then at the end as well. But what we're really trying to apply all this real estate finance to today is the brownfields market. And we have a very simple slide example that we use to sort of divide them up. And if you work in cities or you work with, various regions, you can sort of go through in your head and kind of divide up the sites that you're aware of into these sort of three categories. And, you know, as to the quantity of each of those sites, you know, I think that maybe this triangle's changed a little bit. There used to be a lot more upside-down projects and fewer projects where the real estate value exceeded the remediation costs. The real estate market has obviously helped us a ton over the last 3 or 4 years. You know, good numbers makes all sins go away. And we've learned to understand and deal with environmental issues better, particularly in some of these voluntary cleanup programs where the cleanup can be done in conjunction with the development, and so costs can be reduced. And we've certainly been working with EPA in their programs to coordinate those issues as well. But there's a huge ton of sites that are really in the margin. And, you know, it's sort of the glass half empty, glass half full thing. In some people's eyes, some of these sites are, you know, just, oh my goodness, how could we ever redevelop this site? And in other people's eyes, hey, with a little push, we can get this done. And that's where public programs come in and public financing comes in. And as those of you who are familiar with development, you know that in larger projects, there's always typically some public money involved, whether that's in the back end in tax incentives or it's infrastructure money up front. And so that's also the case, obviously, in the real estate market. And what we're trying to do today is help educate folks a little bit in how private sector tools can be integrated in to really make those deals go. Because if you look at the capital flow, you know, there's millions, tens of millions, in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars in public money that goes into real estate, but there are billions of dollars that go into private real estate. And I don't know, Josh, is there a, do you have a number for that these days, how big the real estate market is?
It's trillions of dollars. I don't have it off the cuff. Yeah, I mean, it's the real estate market, if you were to look at it as far as the size of an economy, basically the largest thing in the United States. Once you start adding in everything, you know, homes and commercial real estate, it's basically the largest part of the American economy outside, of course, U.S. government.
So for a lot of you all who are around this stuff, whether you're an environmental consultant or just reading the papers, you see that ultimately what makes a lot of these deals go is a developer stands up and says, I'll do that deal. And while he may not be putting very much of his own money in that deal, he may be putting in more sweat equity and, you know, maybe a little cash from grandma or his brother or Uncle Jim. Ultimately, he's bringing a major bank or a Wall Street institution to town and saying, okay, we're going to finance the largest part of that. And Josh will talk to you about that a little bit. But if you'll go to the next slide, slide three, you know, when the brownfields market started, there were an awful lot of people out there who were representing themselves as other than they were. And we still find, to be honest with you, that people don't understand the different types of roles that real estate professionals play, and they tend to lump them all as developers, when in fact the developer is probably the guy in the back of the room who's looking out the corner of his eye and to see whether or not this is a deal he really wants to you know, put his next born child into. And all the rest of the people are typically service professionals, real estate brokers, mortgage brokers, attorneys, real estate consultants. If you were to ask Vita Nova, you know, who we are, we're really real estate consultants focused in the brownfields industry. We are not developers. So who is the real developer? What are his attributes? He is the guy, as our partner Barry Hirsch, who might join us later, likes to say, he's the guy with skin in the game. He's the guy who puts up some of his own money at the beginning of the process to get an option on the property or to actually purchase it outright. He must have control of the site. You know, there are a lot of people who talk about deals. There are brokers who have brokerage arrangements on sites. There are municipalities who think they own sites. There are regulatory officials who work on sites. But the developer is the guy who either has an option to purchase the property or who is the actual taxable owner of that property. Financing. And that's a real key thing in looking and evaluating developers, is that you can tell developers apart by their banking relationships. The guy who can bring in the major Wall Street firm for hundreds of millions of dollars is a lot different than the guy who's going to take an equity loan on his house to buy another piece of property. And in evaluating deals and the size of deals, it's important to appropriately match the two based on the capital needs. And that, really, this ability to finance has to do with track record. I'm working on a green housing project with Fannie Mae, who is bringing in developers to help build affordable housing, and they're very particular about who they will work with, and it largely has to do with their having borrowed money before and successfully completed deals and paid Fannie Mae back. And they start very small and they build up over time. And then the issue of a tenant or a user, depending on the type of project, the developer may or may not have a tenant or a user in mind. If it's a real estate project, if it's a retail project, they typically at least have an anchor tenant before they start the project. In commercial office, you know, it varies with the banking relationship, but banks can require that 30, 40, 50, 60% be leased before they put a shovel in the ground. Residential is typically the only category of real estate that does not require that you know exactly who the tenant is going to be before you start. And Josh, feel free to jump in if there's anything you want to add.
I'm listening. No, we're good so far.
Okay. The role of the developer. The developer is really the maestro that puts the whole team together and makes the project work. Typically, development organizations are very small. They may be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people. I think Cherokee, which has its third or fourth $1 billion fund now, has 30 people, would you say, right, Josh? 30 people in North Carolina.
Yeah, that's about right.
And they have a Cherokee Northeast, which is really a development partner, an equity partner, has another 20 or 30. So relatively small organizations, but when they get a development, they put together teams that include a lot of different people, and that's part of their role. The other part of their role is to work with the public sector, to deal with zoning issues, to get the cooperation of government, to get funding if necessary, and, of course, to work closely with the financial entities and bring them in as necessary. In larger deals, you'll find that a number of financial entities may be involved in the project.
Mike?
Yeah.
We're on slide number 4. I'll just point that out there.
Yeah, okay, and I'm actually moving to slide number 5. So, the development team. In a standard development, these people come in and out, but are crucial to the process in providing information, in helping determine what might occur at a site. But include everybody from engineers and architects to brokers to lenders to planners. On contaminated property, obviously, that includes environmental consultants, attorneys, insurers, and, you know, depending on where the site is and what the issues are, it may also involve working with the community.
And the comment, the only thing I would add on this is to understand that basically the development team is extremely flexible. It's not that the developer has all these people's staff, essentially. It's rather that they come together for the project, they complete the project, and then they go back to from whence they came. It's a very fluid process. That's all.
Yeah, usually there's sort of relationships that get built over time. And depending on the type of project, maybe the type of architect that gets brought in or the relationship with the particular municipality. So teams are put together to meet the specific needs of a particular project, but many times developers have people that they sort of work with over time. So if we go through to slide six, there is no development model. This is an academic construction to give you some idea of the steps that developers go through. But if we were really to sort of lay it out, it would be, you know, going around in a circle. So all these steps, or many of these steps, might occur in an iterative sort of process until the thing was built and leased and up and going. But just to give you some sense of how it works is that the developer is usually the guy with the idea. He's the guy that's been looking at that mound of dirt over in the, you know, the back lot and saying, you know what? You know, if I put in a road this way, we could make a hotel back there. And all of a sudden this lousy former junkyard becomes, you know, a multi-million dollar project. And so that idea generation process and that refinement process usually starts with just the idea. And as Josh likes to say, you know, he's doing the math in his head. You know, he's saying...
Yeah, none of this... I mean, one thing which people don't really fully appreciate about real estate finance is at the end of the day, it's really not that hard. I mean, for anyone who's ever gone through, like, an engineering training program, and for those of you on the phone who are not engineers, you know, you work with engineers. They're nice people. They're smart people. But, I mean, the point is that this level of math is something that people definitely can learn. And whereas in engineering you might have to do calculus and what have you, in real estate finance, a lot of times what it really comes down to is you put in a million, you buy land for $1 million, you put in $4 million of work, that's five, and then you sell it for seven. Seven minus five is two. That's more than five, and so you're moving the right direction. It's really that not that hard. It's just not.
At least in terms of the initial cut at it. If it works on paper, if it works as simple math, then it will likely work when you get into, you know, all the financing issues that come later. But in that refinement and due diligence process, new information is added. And so you take that basic formula that Josh just articulated, and you start to say, well, I'm going to have to put in a water line. What's that going to cost me? And, oh, by the way, there is this back lot that I could add, you know, service bays to. You know, what could I rent them for? And as you go through that process, you begin to refine what the development model is, and so you work on securing the deal. And securing the deal can happen in a number of ways. A lot of times, if you're looking to do retail or office, you will try to get an option on the property. And if you get that, which could be 3 months, it could be 6 months, it may cost you nothing, it may cost you $1 million, it may be refundable, it may not be refundable, then you go out and find your tenant. And assuming that you find your tenant in the time frame that you've negotiated, then you go to the bank and you negotiate your deal. The development process obviously occurs after you've purchased the property, and there are phases of that, and depending on the type of development, will depend on what you're doing. If you're selling condos, actually condos in Florida are selling ahead of being developed, but in a lot of cases, residential is not sold until it's built. Whereas in commercial and retail, a lot of times the leasing starts from the day the ground breaks. And then these things are managed over time. And that's really where money is made. And Josh will talk a little bit later about how you make money on leased assets. So if we can go to slide 7. Conceiving the project. Highest and best use. You all have probably heard that. Some of you probably know what that means, but in real estate terms, it's really how can I make the most money off of this piece of property? What does this property really want to be from a real estate finance perspective? And that's a difficult thing for environmental folks, and I happen to agree with you that that isn't necessarily the way we might want to build our neighborhood, but in large respects, because development follows the money, in many cases shopping malls are put where we wish parks were, and housing condos are put where we had hoped to build a little new urbanist village. I think that as land becomes scarcer and as we learn more about traditional neighborhoods and as we learn more about how to build communities, we're seeing more and more creativity in how these developments are put together. It's a matter of the financial tools matching up with the development concepts. As you can imagine, it's pretty easy to sort of lay out and put up a strip mall. It's a little more difficult to think about, a little urban village with a town center and a little square and some stores and some housing above. A little harder to think about, a little harder to finance, that sort of thing. Reuse assessment. When a developer goes to look at a property, he starts with zoning. What is this property currently zoned? But that is by no means where he ends. What the developer many times is doing is recognizing an opportunity in the market that the current zoning does not reflect. So he looks at a piece of property. He may look at a Superfund site and say, yeah, it's zoned industrial. For 50 years there was a manufacturing facility here. You know what? This thing should be age-restricted housing, and I'm going to make money on the difference. And that's how he figures out how to address the demolition issues and the cleanup issues and that sort of thing, because of that margin between what the property may be worth if it were sold as an industrial property and what he can get for it as something else. One of the things we always try to talk about is just this issue of objectionable uses. Anytime you've got a brownfield site, people will say, why don't we put a prison there? Why don't we put a sewage treatment plant there? Why do we really have to improve this? Let's just put the things that really have a hard time finding homes. Almost every site I've worked on, somebody has said, well, can't we put a transfer station here? You always have to resist that temptation and look to, what the site might be better used for. And I guess the key element that the developer brings really is creativity. We do a lot of consulting to corporations trying to help them figure out what to do with their properties, but the one thing we say to them is, look, if we go out to the development community, it's likely that someone will come up with something creative, something that we didn't think of, that will be, that'll be the gem. That'll be the thing that, you want to consider developing your site for. So the development community is this powerful force that, using all these tools, can really overcome a lot of these problems if we know how to properly engage them. And that's been a huge issue in our courses with EPA, is that EPA has a certain language. They have a certain process. They think of things. Definitions don't necessarily mean the same thing to the real estate community as to the environmental community. And what we need to do is understand each other's cultures and not necessarily change, but try to help each other understand from where the other one is coming, so that we might be able to harness the power of the regulatory system, or in this case, the finance system. And that's what Josh is here to do. So you all are familiar, I'm sure, with the current reuse assessment guidance that EPA Superfund has. Essentially, the developer goes through all of those steps to look at potential reuse. They look at the property. They look at how many buildable acres there are. It looks at what the assets are, what the constraints are. It looks at environmental, but when they look at environmental, developers don't just look at the contamination under the ground. They look at wetlands. They look at slopes. They look at other issues that might constrict the amount of buildable land. That's a key issue when looking at the property is, that's fine, it's 200 acres. How many can I actually build on? I just looked at a property last Thursday that is 350 acres. This former mine scarred land. If this site doesn't get compacted, properly compacted when the restoration occurs, there are 100 buildable acres. If it gets compacted, properly, there's 250 buildable acres. So there can be a huge difference, and it's one of the first things that the developer really looks at. Dealing with the community, I'm only going to say a little bit about this because this is really a numbers course, but the developer wants to go where he's wanted. So if the zoning does match up, if there is a favorable city council, if there is a community that says we really would like the grocery store here, the developer would love to go there. There are many developers that recognize that isn't always the case and actually are prepared for a fight when they go in. And it's just a matter of style and approach, and there are both kinds out there, depending on what kind of site it is and what they're doing. Go ahead, Josh.
No, and I was going to say, a lot of that has to do with the sophistication of the developer. I mean, I've got a client right now who's working on a project in the Southwest who bought a former site. It was a 35-acre site. Actually, it's not a brownfield, but it's interesting nonetheless. It was a 35-acre site that Walmart had owned, actually, and it was in an upper-income community. And Walmart realized that the idea of trying to put a Walmart in this upper-income community, even though they thought financially they could make a go of it, they really didn't want to go through the fight. So the guy who bought the thing was a guy who'd done residential subdivisions for years, buys the site from Walmart, gets it fully entitled and approved to build 1.5 million square feet of office, retail, and residential, which at that size should have been an absolute war. But since he knew the community well, he knew the political actors, he was very upfront with the thing, he was able to get all of his entitlements in 6 months, whereas normally if he had tried to fight the thing, if he had been, say, Walmart, you know, maybe he could have pushed the thing through, but it would have taken upwards of 2 years or more. That's a very real-world example of basically how working with a community, and if you're a smart developer, you can basically get things approved by essentially treating government as a partner, not as an impediment. Some developers understand that. Others, either less sophisticated ones or ones who are used to fighting, like, say, Walmart, are more willing to basically drag the battle out and not really play nice.
Well, and you know, Avalon is a good example. They've built, you know, upper-end condos in less dense neighborhoods, and they expect to have to get a zoning change, and many times, because of traffic and other issues, they expect to fight. And so they come in and they hire the best lawyers, and they hire the connected planners, and they hire all the best people they can, but ultimately they're expecting that at the planning and zoning hearing, where they're asking for you know, a change in the zoning for the number of units they want to put in, they're expecting a fight. And they come prepared and they many times win.
Hey, Mike?
Yeah.
Right shortly before you started this discussion of Walmart and Avalon, I received a question. At what point do the developers engage the community? What can developers do to address unrealistic community expectations about parking?
Well, in the ASTM standard that I chaired, Sustainable Brownfields Redevelopment 1984-98, what we said was, and this is a very, you know, sort of pat, generic answer, but we ought to start there, is if it depends on the potential impact of either the environmental or the development. So if the environmental has already impacted the community, then you can be assured that they will be sensitized to this project, and you'd better get in early or to have any sort of chance of gaining their trust. If the environmental cleanup is going to impact the community because you're going to run a lot of dirt through their neighborhoods, well, then you'd better be ready to address that as well. If the development is going to be a large one and it's going to be different than the community's expectations, then you know, I would say the earlier the better. Now, I can tell you that lawyers get paid lots of money to sort of roll the dice and tell their client, is it better just to show up at planning and zoning and forego the community involvement and take our chances with them, or is it better to try to engage the community? Now, and I will tell you that you know, most development attorneys tend to be skeptical about community involvement, and so community involvement is not practiced broadly with a lot of development folks. But I can tell you that we run a lot of charrettes, and my own particular practice is working in highly charged neighborhoods with you know, with tough expectations, and I have found that people can be reasonable if they are not already polarized. If they're already upset, and you've upset them, and you can't get over that, that's going to be hard. But if you can get in early and work as a cooperative partner, and show them that you have their best interest at heart. And particularly on a big site where you can give them something that they want, if they'll give you something that you want, these issues can be worked through. I don't know, Josh, do you want to?
Yeah, I mean, in general, I agree with that conceptually. I mean, it's funny, and I say this as someone who basically works on the private sector side, to essentially say, well, you know, when I talk to colleagues of mine who work in development, you know, I mean, if you're actually building something in a community which services the community's needs, like, let's say a Walmart, okay, why do you build a Walmart in a community? Well, answer, because you expect people in that community to shop there, right? It doesn't make a lot of sense for a developer to say, well, I'm going to build this thing that I think the community wants, but I think that if I build it, lots of people will come out and sign and say, we don't want it. It's like, well, yeah, that's true on one part, but there'll also be other people who do want it, you know? And it's part of it is to say to a developer, to work with a developer, to identify community groups who actually would be in favor of what the guy's wanting to do. And a lot of times you'll find that, you know, you're not looking to build consensus to say that, well, everybody agrees that this is a great idea, but rather to get everyone to understand that for the good of the community it makes sense, you know.
So we could talk about this issue forever, and we're happy to do it probably offline. I just thought of another half dozen examples, but I hope that generally answers the question.
Well, we do have one more question.
Okay.
I just want to respond to before you move on.
Okay.
How significant is the role of the planner in the pre-development stage, specifically in the idea generation phase? Does the developer or another party typically retain the planner?
Not really. I mean, generally, developers are usually the ones who are coming up with the ideas. Planners are usually the ones who are saying what the community's needs are, looking at issues like saying, well, you know, we've got, like if it's a municipal planner, would be saying, well, you know, what about traffic impacts, what about schools? But usually as far as raw idea generation, You know, some planners are very good, but in general, I sort of still side with developers to say that if anyone's going to be the creative one, it's usually the developer.
Well, why don't we look at it this way, though, as opposed to saying planner, the municipality can have a huge role, whether that's economic development, whether that's an economic development agency, whether that's the planning office. It depends on the quality and talent of those folks. They can be usually important in helping developers not waste their time. If you know what you'd like to see in your community, and you're right from a market perspective what's possible, then developers can work hand in glove with you. And to be honest, in these cases where these situations don't work very well, it's because somebody was caught sleeping. You know, the zoning didn't change to meet what the new demand was. You know, there was no one to work with the municipality, so the developer came in, kind of took things on their own. Whereas if communities are keeping up their municipal plans and they're helping gate expectations both on the development side and the community side, then they can play a real mediating and moderating role in all this. But, you know, it really depends. But Josh is right. The developers are the ones closest to it, and if they're working with a good planner, they'll be whispering in their ears, you know, we really think this site ought to be so-and-so. What do you think? Can we move on?
Go ahead.
Okay, the last piece of reuse assessment, and then I'm going to turn it over to Josh, who is who knows a fair bit about the next subject, is just that the reuse assessment that EPA has put out does not cover financial issues. And so what it typically does, or someone who's using it does, is they go in and interview a few people. They kind of figure out what the current zoning is. But the piece that's missing, and the piece that you all as practitioners or EPA folks or whoever you're representing today need to think about when you think about the reuse of a property, is what does the market say? What will financially work? And it's really a combination of the zoning and what the community wants and the market that ultimately creates the end use that that ultimately goes there. And so that's the piece of it. That's the creative piece that has to go into each of these. And so that's why there are reuse processes around Superfund sites. That's why that EPA is sort of promoting this collaborative partnership between the public and private sector to try to get that into the process so some of these sites can actually get developed. And I'd like to move on to the market and just say that Josh just recently wrote a book that's out. You can all buy it. The title is on his resume. And we hope that it will become standard fare for business schools.
We're trying.
Well, you can certainly pick it up at NYU Business School and most of the places that Josh frequents. Josh, I'll turn it over to you and shut up for a while.
Okay. There we go. I'll get started here. Let's see here. Okay, so reuse assessment, let me just click on to market analysis and feasibility. So if we're on slide 9, let's talk about market analysis and feasibility. When taught at the graduate level, this actually is a semester-long course. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a semester-long course called Market Analysis and Feasibility, on which my textbook basically is based and works around, and try to whittle it down into about 10 slides. That's the plan anyway. So essentially you can split it up this way. Market analysis is the question of who is the end user. And then the second question is, of course, once you've identified what the market is, residential, office, whatever it is, what price will the end user pay? That's the second part, the feasibility issue. pardon me. This is not, so to speak, field of dreams, build it and they will come, right? It's not enough to simply say what the market is. You have to actually, after you identify the market, say, okay, now what? How do we actually pay for the thing? It's a natural tendency whenever you're working on sites like this, especially when you're dealing with community groups, community group will say, well, we think there's a great market for a park, to which I often will respond, well, that's great. I mean, I'm sure there's a demand for green space, but how are we going to pay for it? And that's often the question that a lot of community groups have never actually tried to tackle. So, of course, in the private sector, you need to deal with both pieces. One of the things when you're dealing with environmental sites is you deal with the impact of stigma. Essentially, that just because you say the site is clean doesn't mean that necessarily everybody now gets on board and believes you, doesn't mean that everybody is ready to start accepting it as being an equivalent value. And the impact of stigma can have a significant impact on not only the price that land sells for, but also what it rents for, basically the general value of the site. So how do you deal with stigma? How do you reposition the site? Well, the good news is that repositioning of sites, that's basically what private sector developers have been doing for years. And when you think about what they do as a business, they're in the business of basically going to a community and explaining to the community that whereas now the community, the site currently is maybe an abandoned industrial facility, it really would be much better if it were a retail shopping center. You know, and that's essentially pre-development marketing. That's working with the community to get them to re-envision the site as some new use. That skill set is really essential for dealing with the impact of stigma. And so one place that the private sector can be really engaged on this is basically through marketing, through working with communities to essentially get them to re-envision the site as some new use. Part of that process, or part of that conversation, always brings us along to build-to-suit. A lot of people, when they look at these sites, they say, well, wouldn't it be great if we could just get a Home Depot? We'll just get Home Depot, they'll put a huge building on top of this piece of dirt, it'll cap the whole thing, and we'll be good to go. Whereas that's all lovely and fine if it happens, it rarely happens. And build-to-suit, while it could happen, is not the foundation of a sound market study. A sound market study looks at supply, demand, economic issues, and tries to understand what is going, what basically the best use will be. If we pop along to slide 10, we make it to feasibility due diligence. Assuming we have the market under control, the next piece is just to say, what is most feasible? What really financially could work there? Essentially, this comes down to quantifying the risk, and then will the project show sufficient return for the work and risk? And by risk, I do not mean environmental risk. I mean financial risk. Because remember, we have risk in both worlds, right? We have risk in environmental, which is risk to health, human safety, environment, that sort of thing. We have risk in the financial world, which is to say, will I make money? And not only will I make money, what kind of risk am I taking on that not only will I not make money, but that'll lose money, right? Now, of course, when you look at a contaminated site, the financial risk is higher. Why is the financial risk higher on a contaminated site? Because basically there are all these intangibles, all these things could get in the way of redeveloping it. There's the issue of stigma. There's the issue of increased government regulation. There's the issue of the fact that you actually do have environmental problems, and that adds a whole variability to the cost. All kinds of fun things come in there when you try to calculate what the potential is. If we pop along to slide 11, everybody popping? Yeah, get along to slide 11. If we move along to slide 11, under fatal flaw analysis, we look at the kind of issues that the developer tries to identify as risk issues that are so big that they're just going to blow the whole thing up. First one, cleanup approach not quantified. Nothing worse in the world than saying to an environmental regulator, from the point of view of the developer, this is, what is the best cleanup method for this? How much will it cost? And the regulator says, we don't know what's on the site. Not only that, we don't know how much it will cost to clean. An answer like that basically just blows the deal up. And that's okay. It's okay if that kills the deal, because the point is, once we understand what the cleanup approach is and how much it's going to cost and how long it'll take, then we can circle back and deal with that site. So if you have sites where the cleanup approach is not quantified, just move on to other sites. I'm sure you have other sites that are farther down the cleanup process that people can work on. Extraordinary construction costs. One of the problems, of course, with environmentally challenged sites is that whatever the environmental issue is, not only do you have to clean it up, but often it makes it more difficult to build on that site once it is controlled. That, of course, can make the project fail. Major regional employer leaves. Often on these sites, the reason they're abandoned is because the previous employer left the site. that previous employer, especially if you're in a one-factory town type environment, basically, when the employer left, so did the whole real estate market. Not much you can do about that. You know, I mean, there are a lot of beautiful little towns which could be really great real estate plays if there was any reason to build anything there, but there's no employer, so what are you going to do? Real estate, for the most part, is a derived demand. I mean, when you think about what makes homes expensive or not expensive, it's not because the homes are expensive or not expensive because people want the homes. Rather, people want the homes because of other things that they do. Everything, home demand is essentially derived from other things. People want a home because of access to work, because of access to amenities, because of historical reasons. All kinds of factors go in there. Often, of course, the major one reason being access to employment. NIMBY, not in my backyard, we talked about that. Essentially, if you have a community which is so militant against anything happening, you've got a problem. And, of course, stigma. Some sites are basically just notorious at this point. Now, that said, of course, even areas like, say, Three Mile Island did eventually redevelop. I mean, you can still have a national-class disaster happen at the site, and people could eventually move back. It would just take a while. Slide 12 introduces us to the idea of a back-of-the-envelope analysis. On a basic feasibility approach, you've got to look at the land. Before you even talk about buildings, just look at the land. So let's say you have a piece of land that's clean at $1 million, and you could buy it for $300, and you could fix it up for $400, and you could pay off a municipal lien for $100, and spend $200,000 in soft costs. Soft costs basically being any money, as they kiddingly say on development jobs, hard costs is money you spend that results in a building, soft costs, money you spend that results in paper, right? So soft costs would be architects, engineers, planners, what have you.
Many of the people on this phone.
Pretty much everybody on this phone would count the soft costs, because I imagine pretty much no one here actually swings a hammer for a living, right? So that would add up to $1 million. If you spend that $1 million and you compare it to, say, the land value of clean of $1 million, you got to ask yourself, does it work? And the short answer in this case is no. Why? Well, it doesn't take into account time value of money, right? Doesn't take into the account that this $1 million takes time, right? And time is money, literally, in a financial sense. We're not going to get into all the math about that, but that's one intuitive approach. The other, of course, is you're taking on all this risk. If I was given the option of paying $1 million, and I knew it would be $1 million, or paying $1 million with a lot of variability in the $1 million, you know, there's something to be said for certainty, for lack of better, you know, old phrase, bird in the hand, two in the bud, right? Given the option, you'd much rather spend $1 million just to buy the land clean. So that's another issue. And, of course, one thing you want to do as a developer is control these costs. Slide 13, 14, 15, the next few slides basically take us through basics of real estate finance. We've been sort of dancing around real estate finance, but I think it's worth sort of going through some terminology. A lot of this terminology in the Real Estate 100 course, we cover sort of as we talk. But here what we've done is we put together some slides just to sort of drill out the terminology so you know it, so you've got it.
Well, and then what we're going to do, just so you know, we're going to show you a pro forma. We're going to show you how that concept works within the context of a pro forma. And then we're going to show you, a case example and how that pro forma works within the context of a case example. So unless there's something you really don't get, just hold until we get to the example, and then we can go back and talk through some of this stuff.
Okay. So, for example, what's a pro forma? A pro forma is simply a cash flow statement. Basically shows what are you going to make, what are you going to spend. And, you know, this has a lot of different names. Some people call it a pro forma. Some people call it a cash flow or operating statement. Some people call it an income and expense analysis. Periodically, you'll see an appraiser call it an annual property operating data. Long story short, it's how much are you going to make, otherwise known as a pro forma. What goes into a pro forma? Well, this is a sample one, and this basically introduces us to the idea of real estate finance basics. So, for example, people in real estate talk about leverage being a really key factor. And basically, you can't buy real estate without debt. The reason being is that debt has such an impact on the value of real estate. But if you tried to buy it without debt and everyone else was using debt, they would outbid you any day of the week because they have the advantage of leverage and you don't. So, case in point, you buy a property, build a property, one way or another, put a property together for $100,000. And let's say the gross income, in other words, income before expenses, so that's like the rents you're collecting, $14,000. And the operating expenses are, say, $4,000, which means the net is $10,000. In other words, if you're netting $10,000 after expenses and you spent $100,000 to get the property together, you're making 10% on your money. And you might say, well, gee, 10%, that's a reasonable rate of return. Here's where it becomes much more interesting, though. Let's say that instead of spending 100 cash, you spend 20 cash and you borrow 80 from the bank. And let's say you pay 6% in expenses to borrow that $80,000. So now your gross is 14, your expenses are 4, your debt service, otherwise known as your carrying cost or your mortgage payment, is 4,800. Your net cash flow is 5,200, which means your net cash flow divided by your equity of 20 is 26% on your money. So instead of putting up 100 to buy the building and making 10, you're putting up 20 and making 5,200. In other words, you make 26% on your money.
Well, and the other piece to that is what do you do with the remaining cash?
And what you do with the remaining $80,000 that you would have spent otherwise is buy another 4 properties. So not only are you making more money on your equity, but you're buying multiple properties, thereby diversifying your income. All in all, you've come out ahead. Right.
One of our other partners just, I guess a couple years ago now, completed his master's in real estate at Columbia. I don't know, what did he spend for that, Josh? 80 grand?
100 grand? Yeah, I think that's what the MSRE was.
He said that the only thing he got for that amount of money is what you just learned.
Well, that's possible. I have to teach at Columbia's program, so I'm a little biased, of course. I'd like to believe I'm adding slightly more. But I don't know. Maybe it's just my humor.
But for absolutely free, we just gave you the secret to the Columbia Business School.
Well, for the extra humor, for the extra 80, you get humor in my stunning good looks. So,
you
know, there's an advantage, of course, to attending my class. But, you know, well, what can I do? Moving right along. So, for example, let's talk about the different pieces here of what goes into this cash flow analysis. And this is terminology, stuff we haven't defined earlier. Slide 15, potential gross income. This is the amount of money you can make if essentially everybody was there and everybody paid you, which, of course, is never the case. You always have some sort of either vacancy or collection loss. Vacancy, they're not there. Collection loss, they're there, they don't pay you. And operating expenses, which we'll define in a bit. Where does potential gross income come from? There's contract rent and there's market rent. And we'll talk about both of those in the course in 200. Contract rent is what the lease says they pay you. Market rent is if you got rid of that tenant, if the tenant left, their lease comes up, you know, they're evicted, they leave one way or another, what would you get for the space if you went out to the market? Of course, contract is a known fact. Market is an estimate, because it's not like you're buying toothpaste at the grocery store. Toothpaste at the grocery store, you could walk in, you could look at the price on the toothpaste, and you could decide how many tubes you want to buy, because the price is right there. Real estate, you don't really know what the price is. You don't really know what you're going to get until you actually go to market. And, of course, then by that point, you have vacant space, and, well, you know, that's not where you want to be. Vacancy and collection loss, we talked a little bit about this on slide 17. Essentially, some sort of allowance is made to potential income for vacancy, turnover, and non-payment of rent. For example, nationwide for office buildings right now, the nation is running about a 13% vacancy rate for Class A office buildings. Those would be your highest grade of office building. That's a pretty high vacancy rate. Nationwide, usually this country runs anywhere from about 5 to 10, 10% in weaker markets and smaller markets, 5% in stronger markets. So New York City, long-term vacancy is like 7%, whereas in, say, Boston, it might be 9 or 10 or whatever. The idea being essentially, at any given time, some space is vacant. People move in, people move out, that sort of thing. So slide 18, potential gross income less vacancy gets us to effective gross income. Essentially, what are you actually collecting? So this is if you added up the checks you get from tenants at the end of the year, this is what you received. Slide 19, operating expenses. The money you spend to basically maintain the facility. And on slide 20, we have examples of operating expenses. The biggest three usually are the first three, taxes, insurance, and utilities. Now, by taxes, we mean real estate or property taxes, not income taxes. That's separate. That's not an operating expense. And other things, repairs and maintenance, general and administrative, management, salaries, what have you. Slide 21 gets us to net operating income. Net operating income is the gold standard by which real estate is measured. Essentially, income less expenses is net operating income, the amount of money you make year to year from the operation of the building. So this doesn't include selling the building. This doesn't include buying more buildings. It just is looking at one building standing on its own. What does that building make year to year before, you know, before it's capitalized, before mortgage debt service, depreciation, and replacement reserves? In other words, before the impact of leverage, taxation, and capital improvements. In other words, we're just looking at net income. We're not looking at you have a mortgage on the property. We're not looking at income taxes. We're not looking at capital items. Slide 22. So, PGI less vacancy equals EGI. EGI less OPEX, or operating expenses, equals NOI. Slide 23. So let's say you have a net income from year to year. The next piece is this concept called cap rate, otherwise known as capitalization rate. Essentially, how do we take that income and we figure out what the purchase price should be? What we do is we take the net operating income and we divide it by some yield, some rate of return we'd like to earn. That's the cap rate. That's how we get the purchase price. Now, how do you know what cap rate to use? Essentially, the cap rate is a market-driven number. So someone will look at a really high-quality building, and they'll say, well, for that really great building, I would buy it. If I could buy it and make 6% of my money, that would be a reasonable yield. Someone else might look at some really beat-up building and say, well, for that beat-up building and that physical condition with that low credit quality of tenants, I could accept a 10% yield. That would be a reasonable rate of return on that building.
So give some examples, Josh.
So, for example, a Class A office building in downtown Philadelphia would probably require about a 5.5% yield on money. So you'd want 5.5% on your money, you'd be good to go. On the other hand, if you say you had a 1950s office building in downtown Tulsa, Oklahoma, that would be more like an 8% and change. Even worse, if you had, say, a Motel 6 outside of Tulsa in poor condition, a hotel, whereas it's the same location as Tulsa, and it might be the same physical condition, that motel, as, say, the office building, because the motel has much more variable cash flow, right? You don't have long-term tenants. You know, you have good months, you have bad months. Maybe that might be a 10 or 12% on your money. Those are some examples. And the point is that cap rates are driven by the market. It's a measure of risk and reward. So you look at all the risks, physical condition, location of the property, various factors like that, to try to figure out what a reasonable yield is. And, of course, one could spend their whole life studying this. I mean, basically, what real estate investors spend their life doing is looking at assets, looking at what the yields are that people are asking for them, and figuring out what the yield should be. And, of course, if you can figure out the yields better than other people, you can make a stunning amount of money. I mean, that's real estate investment in, like, you know, a minute or less. Slide 24. Just as you have purchase cap rates to figure out what you should buy it for, you have terminal cap rates to figure out what you should sell it for. Same concept, just different term. The only small nuance to this is when you're looking at the terminal cap rate, people often look not at the last year of them holding the property, but rather the first year of the new buyer. The idea being that the new buyer is a lot more concerned about their first year of income than they are about your last year. That's really the only trick of terminal cap rates. Other than that, it's the same as before. So here on slide 25, we have a picture. It says simply value equals NOI divided by cap rate. The idea being really simple. The higher the cap rate, the lower the value of the building. And, you know, to look at this formula another way, you could also read this as saying, well, if instead of a cash flow of 120 and 8% of my money, I pay $1.5 million, think about it the other way and say, well, I put $1.5 million in the bank, I make 8% interest, I make $120,000. slide 26 is more in cap rates, and I think by this point we basically beat in the cap rates subject to death. As you can see, different cap rates, different property classes. There's a lot of
these are actually collected and calculated by major.
This is PricewaterhouseCoopers. PricewaterhouseCoopers, the accounting firm, has the CorpAs annual survey, where basically they contact about 300 institutional real estate investors and say, given certain property types, what yields would you look for? And it's a survey, and like any survey, it has certain inaccuracies inherent in it. You know, people lie, people make statements which may not be entirely, you know, truthful. But nonetheless, you know, it's a starting point.
But what it does show you is that, you know, in the same way that somebody would go out and look at three comparables to look at your house, someone could go to downtown Dallas and look at office buildings downtown, and they're going to look at how are they comparably priced, and look to find an average of that, and that's the starting point for you know, for establishing the cap rate for that building.
Right. So on to slide 27. Slide 27 is when we start into Sarasota. Mike, did you want to stop and take questions at this point, I think? More Sarasota?
Yeah, we could, or we can go through the case study and show them the Sarasota pro forma, and then I think that would be a really good time to take questions.
Okay. Well, then I'll just keep cranking along through Sarasota.
I never got your new picture in there, so it's a little dark, so you'll have to explain to them what they're looking at.
Okay, and of course I don't have a pointer, or at least none that they can see. So Sarasota is an actual project that basically when I was at James and Moore Brookhill we worked on. The site's in, well, Sarasota, Florida. It's along I-75. And that road on the right side of the photo in slide 27, that's Fruitvale Road, which is a major road that basically goes into Sarasota. The site is 84 acres, and that site is basically that building on the corner, the building, the big white building thing in the middle, pretty much, well, a lot of what you see, basically that building in the middle, some of the land in the back of it, it's a big site. It's 84 acres.
And that big triangle there in the front.
And the triangle in the front. All that is part of the 84 acres. The building in the middle, that's an industrial building of 284,000 feet, pretty sizable structure. And previous historic use was manufacturing. It was actually owned by Lockheed Martin. They had a company here called L3. The business of Lockheed Martin at the time was, at the site, was essentially making black boxes for planes. Flight recorders, which, of course, as we discovered, were actually orange, fun things you discover as you go through life and in the real estate business. So if you look at slide 28, you'll see a very happy-looking photo, and the sky is that blue. The water, that's a retention pond, which really has never looked that good, but nonetheless, that's the pond. The plan was to renovate the existing building for office and light industrial use. Take that frontage, that triangle in the front that you can see on slide 27, and renovate it into restaurants, hotels, and highway-oriented retail. The triangle in the front was so in demand that they literally would get phone calls from brokers every week saying, can we buy the site on the front? There was huge demand for that corner. It's on a major interstate. There's a huge retail facility across the street. But, of course, because of environmental issues, they couldn't, which we'll talk about in a moment. The back acreage, meanwhile, we figured we could use for big box or distribution. So given this huge plan, why didn't someone do it already? Well, if you go to slide 29, you'll see that they were active RCRA, HSWA permits, consent order in place, significant land, water, and soil contamination on and off site, the most important, of course, being a 45-acre TCE plume that was primarily focused around that 284,000-foot facility. We had a few things on our hands when we wanted to deal with this. The first issue was dealing with stigma. This site was formally known by the community as the site that EPA helicoptered onto. Now, the region denies that they ever actually helicoptered onto the site. However, they do admit that they do own a helicopter. That was the farthest we could get anyone to agree to say. Nonetheless, the community knew it as this. It was this relatively notorious site. So, how do you deal with that? Well, it's through creativity. our firm was contacted at the time by the local 4-H Club, which wanted to basically put a fair on the site. Now, normally when a group like the 4-H Club calls, well, you support their endeavors, you know, you really don't want to deal with it. There's insurance issues, there's trash. It's often not really worth the aggravation. But in this case, we said, you know, we'd love to have you on the site. The reason being, of course, we wanted to get into the paper that the site was now not only undergoing renovation, but the 4-H Club had used it for basically having their annual fair. It's little things like that, right, where you drag a few politicians out, you get the press corps and what have you, that can really change the conception of a site, and of course matter a lot when you're trying to reposition it. The other part of this, as far as dealing with the site, was actually dealing with the actual environmental issue. Under the consent order they had, it would take roughly probably about 30 years to clean the site. Because basically, to put it in academic terms, coming from the point of view that I do actually teach at the college level, the students were essentially going for a C. You know, they wanted to pass the class, they didn't really want to pass it too well, and because why bother, essentially? They just need the grade and they need to get through it. We, on the other hand, we were going for an A. We wanted to get it cleaned up quickly. We wanted to get it cleaned up to a very high level of cleanliness so we could then go to potential buyers for those sites and be able to say things like that the contamination level was at a very low level. So we were able to actually, through essentially being more aggressive, both through mobile treatment units, also by upping the speed of cleanup, we were able to cut the cleanup time from a little over 30 years to a bit under 5. Put another way, the company environmental people saw this very much as a lifetime employment thing. They just really weren't in they really, frankly, weren't motivated to clean it any faster than the government wanted them to. Now, as for the actual deal, which is on slide 30, essentially the plan was to acquire the land and building for $10 million, pay $3 million for remediation. Now, how do we get to that number? The seller says yes, our appraiser says it's worth 13 clean. And we said, great. We'll buy the land and the building for 10 because, and why did we get to that number of 10? Because we figured it would be $3 million to clean. We provided them with an insurance-backed indemnification policy. Now, of course, we as the buyer, we were buying it in an LLC, which was basically an empty shell, but we were backed up by a very sizable insurance policy by AIG. So in the event that we didn't clean it up, we still had AIG to step into our shoes. And the major point, of course, being that the seller's goal was achieved. They got their appraised value less the remediation cost, so basically they achieved their dollar number, and we were able to make money for the simple reason that we could mitigate the risk and, you know, solve the sites. Exit strategy on slide 31. Improved groundwater treatment system to under 5 years. Did that. We sold the retail and industrial properties as they were cleaned up. As the plume retreated, we could clean the sites, sell the sites. We leased the existing building. Lockheed didn't want the whole facility. And the plan was to eventually either refinance or sell the property when everything was fully occupied. That was the plan, and basically it pretty much went that way. It was a relatively successful development. On slide 32 and 33, or actually slide 32, you can see what I mean by successful, and this is by real estate definitions. You can see that we spent $10.4 to buy the building. So that's $10.2 for the building and $200 for insurance and attorneys. Then we spend about $3 million to clean it up, $4 and change to rehab the existing building, $2 for subdivision roads. You'll note that remediation from the point of view of a redeveloper is essentially nothing more than another line item, right? Whereas for you in an environmental role, it of course is what occupies your days and nights. It's basically what you do. For real estate developers, it's just another line item. And our goal is to control the cost and the time so we can put it into our cash flow projections just as we would put in roads, utilities, rehab, what have you.
I think the thing you have to say, Josh, is that developers understand that there's a lot of backup to that number, but this is the kind of math they ultimately want to be able to do, recognizing that there are an awful lot of different moving parts on these sites. And the last thing they need is something like the environmental to come unhinged.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, to put it this way, construction has more than enough problems as is. I mean, construction, you know, you've got materials show up late, you can have labor disputes, you can all kinds of fun things go wrong on you. But at a certain point, as with construction, it has to stop being a conversation, and at a certain point, drill down to being a dollar amount and a time frame. You know, and of course, there's a lot of chit chat and a lot of reports behind that, but it still needs to drill down to that point. We have soft costs, of course. We had carrying costs. Carrying costs, basically, that's another way of saying that we're paying mortgage payments, taxes, what have you. Very condensed here, but it'll work for our conversation. That comes out to a total project cost of about $23 million. Now, of course, we're selling these. Now, okay, so we're in for 23.6. That's total project costs. How do we make money now that we know we're spending 23? Well, we figured we could sell the existing building for $23 million. We had an income of a little under 5, expenses of a little under 3. That's a net of 2. The 2 divided by that cap rate gets us to 23, and the cap rate, again, is an estimate of what the market will buy the building for. The land sales, in turn, we figured we could sell the land once it was cleaned for about 12.5, which means we're in for 23, out for 36, which means we make 12. If we do it over 2 years, we've made roughly 26% on our money. And, of course, this is a very simplified version. In a full Excel spreadsheet for this, you could basically have 10 different spreadsheets, each of which are very sizable in their own right, all of which are linked together, all of which have lots of moving pieces. And one can basically spend years of one's life really mastering Microsoft Excel and how to build a flexible, robust, and complete spreadsheet. There's just a lot of stuff going on.
If you want to know more, Josh does PhD courses all around the country, either in Excel or in Argus, which is...
Argus is a specialized program for the analysis of office, industrial, and retail. It's a whole thing I do, and I travel New York, Chicago, Boston, and L.A., basically training people how to use it. And so that, you know, occupies my time when I'm not, you know, traveling around with Mike doing stuff for the feds. So it's good stuff.
Josh, Diane, now would be a good time for folks to ask questions. Are there any?
Great.
Okay, well, I do have some online, and before I get to them, I just want to remind people who are new to the Cluin seminar, if you'd like to submit a question online, just go to the question mark icon at the top of your slide, type in your question and hit submit, and I'll get it here. And we'll open the phone line shortly if anybody wants to chime in. But, Mike, we have 3 questions. The first one dates back to slide number 7. I don't know if you want to address that or dive right into the finance-oriented question.
Well, if it's short, let's try it. But
okay.
What is it?
You talked about an example of how an industrially zoned property may be better utilized as age-restricted residential property. What about sites that can only attain regulatory closure / cleanup goals through deed restrictions or environmental covenants that restrict land use to commercial or industrial use? Many of these properties are in highly desirable areas that will see radical redevelopment in the future. Do you foresee a lot of properties violating or repealing these restrictions in the future?
That is a longer question. I'll give you the short answer, which is, if you do age-restricted housing right, or you do condos or townhouses where the ownership is held in common, you can achieve commercial standards. The only issue you're going to have is on things like volatilization, where you've got the 24-hour indoor air issue. As far as violating, I mean, you know, yeah, the regulators are all worried about that, but I think that if we have the right checks and balances in place, rather than violate, we'll revisit and we'll clean up sites further as the market demands and creates the capital to do that, as sites move from pre-industrial through industrial to ultimately to residential. But in the what we're seeing as a trend is that lots and lots of commonly owned properties, residential properties, are being built on contamination that can be capped and that a land use restriction can be placed so that no one can have a private garden or a pool, and there are common charges to maintain the caps, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's all I want to say about that, because I want to stick with the finance part of this. So if you want to go on to the other questions, that would be good.
Okay. Are cap rates for a particular property dependent also upon the condition or value of the surrounding property? For example, an office building next to a contaminated manufacturer.
Josh?
Contamination would have to be pretty bad to really start impacting the cap rates of neighboring properties. That's like one of those depends kind of things. It would really have to be very bad, though.
But there is a correlation between the location of your property and the potential cap rate. I mean, Rockefeller.
There is, but usually that's location as far as distance to employment, distance to amenities, what have you. I mean, just the fact that it's, nearby a site which has some contamination, and half the people don't know if there's a site that's contaminated next door to them to start with.
The real equation there is, if stigma affects the leasability of a site, it will ultimately affect the cap rate. And, I can give you an example right now where there's a perfectly usable commercial building that is actually attached to a former factory. So in other words, it was the office portion of the factory, but the factory is still there in total disrepair and needs to be torn down. They cannot lease that building because even though they've created separate parcels, the buildings are still attached and it's created such a stigma they can't lease the office buildings. So in that case, sure. But if you've got a perfectly leasable piece of property and it's easy on and easy off, and et cetera, et cetera, and it doesn't affect the lease rates, it's not going to affect the cap rate.
Right.
Except as, location, in general affects it.
Ready for the next question?
Sure.
Yep.
What kind of success have you had with environmental insurance? You mentioned AIG backing you up for the sample project where you estimated a $3 million cleanup.
Josh, you want to start?
Actually, I'm going to let you start on that one, Mike.
Okay.
As far as,
insurance is absolutely a valuable tool. The issue is that it's only really accessible to commercial projects where there's enough of a cash flow to afford the insurance. We find that in deals where there is some risk that cannot be addressed or quantified in some physical environmental cleanup way, particularly third party and regulatory comeback or, changes in the regulations, that insurance for those aspects can be invaluable. We also find that insurance can be a super tool to support land use restrictions. So if a tenant were to, or a contractor or a utility corridor worker should puncture a cap, it's great to have insurance to be able to address those kinds of issues. It's been touted among those who don't use insurance a lot as a great tool for addressing cost overruns in remediation. Most of the insurance companies have found that the money that they made in addressing third party and other liability issues, they've paid back in those kinds of policies because there are just too many people who know how to puncture those policies and look at it as sort of a cash cow when it's in place. So absolutely, it's a great tool, and there are at least a dozen companies that are writing different kinds of insurance. Like any kind of insurance, it's impacted by the financial markets and risk issues generally. After 9/11, there was a cooling off in the environmental markets, but it's back, and I think that, in truth, there needs to be more public-private partnerships so that the regulatory community sort of defines what the risks are that they want the insurance industry to address, and that would help make the tools even more applicable. So, for example, now you can only get a 5 or 10 or 15-year policy at the most, We'd really like 25 and 50-year policies, but I think that's going to require government cooperation. So, Josh?
That pretty much covers it. That's okay. I'm not going to run about any further than that point.
How about some new questions about finance?
Okay. First of all, I apologize to the people who are audio streaming who can't hear me. I'm trying to speak up. The next question, what inhibits property owners from doing the pro forma math and deciding to develop it themselves? What percentage of the redevelopment market is led by the original owner?
Good question. I'd say the majority of it is not led by the original owner. I mean, it's not that they can't do the pro forma math. I guess I'd bounce it back to the questioner to say, well, why don't you do it? And the short answer is because you don't have the skill set or the time or the access to capital to do it. I mean, redeveloping a site into a shopping center is not something that's undertaken by dilettantes or people, you know, with, you know, 3 hours on the weekend after they've done mowing the lawn. It's basically a full-time job. It requires years of training, and there's a lot more to it than just doing the math. I mean, the math tells you whether or not it's going to be a good idea, but then you actually have to go do it.
And it's a personality type. It's people who can accept a certain amount of risk, who, you know, I don't know, Josh, you want to talk about your dad a little more?
I could get into it. I mean, basically, yeah, my father's made a ton of money and lost a ton of money twice. My family's gone personally bankrupt twice, so my family went belly up, including myself, because part of the entity, in 79 and again in 91. Most people consider bankruptcy to be a bad thing. For the point of view of real estate developers, part of the game. It takes a certain mindset to be willing to risk it all in such a way. You put that together with just 100 other things. The real major one being your tolerance for risk. That's why most people don't do it. It's just a very risky endeavor. I mean, we haven't really gone into the numbers on what happens when it goes bad, but it can go bad.
Yeah, and Josh's father is by no means unique. Those were bust cycles in the real estate market, and tons of people declared bankruptcy during those periods. And so the point being that these guys are signing personally, guys or girls, ladies, are signing personally their house away, their firstborn son, on the bet that they can get this project done, they can wrestle the environmental down, they can build the building, they can lease it up, and the world isn't going to end before it all gets done.
Great.
Other questions, Diane?
No, but I offer up to the people who have got a phone line, press, let's see, pound 6 to unmute yourself if you'd like to submit a question.
Does anybody want to talk to us? We'll just talk to ourselves there, right, Josh?
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay, well, if not, I'll just remind everybody, in order to submit a question online, press the question mark at the top of the slides and then submit your question. Is that somebody coming on?
I don't know.
All right, I guess you guys continue.
Okay, so I'll keep going.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, at this point you've seen an example of how we put these concepts together into a real deal. And we're going to talk further about some of the basic issues related to finance. But I would say that, again, this is just to get folks aware of the concepts, and that you know, the courses we teach provide much more of an opportunity to actually apply them. So with that, Josh, go ahead.
Sure. Okay. So let me get back to this. Okay, so for example, slide 32, basically we just finished, that was talking about performance. Slide 33 revisits the concept of leverage. So in this case, we've added some more zeros here. Same concepts again. So you buy something for $10 million, you make $1 million, that's 10%. That's your cash-on-cash return. Same idea as before. We saw leverage, 20% cash, 80% borrowed. What then? Well, your leverage return with a 6% mortgage is 26%, which sounds familiar because we discussed that earlier. But with an 11% mortgage, you're making only 6%. The idea, of course, being that the higher the interest rate, the less useful leverage is. And in fact, if the interest rate on the mortgage goes too high, you could actually end up where leverage doesn't work for you, but rather it works against you. Now, why do we dwell on this point? Well, we're going to, actually, we'll come back to it in a moment. Just hold on in your brain the part about leverage being good or bad depending on interest rates. We'll come back to that when we get to slide 35. The second part, once we get to the idea that leverage varies the deal, is the idea that the cap rates can vary the deal also. So, for example, let's say a building makes $1 million and the cap rate is 8%, so the building's worth 12.5. And let's say the way we got to that NOI of $1 million was because the rent is 30, the operating expenses are 20 a foot, and the NOI is then 10. And if you've got 10 floors at 10,000 feet each, well, that's $1 million of income. What if one of the floors, instead of being rented at 30, we rent it at 28? A marginal difference from 30, right? Because 30 bucks a foot for a floor versus 28 bucks a foot, it's a small change in gross rent. But that small change of less than 10% in gross rent is magnified to a 20% drop in net operating income, which means basically we really get dinged, to put it a simple way. Because the idea is we're not capping the gross rent, we're capping the NOI. The point of this whole exercise being that small changes in rent result in larger changes in NOI, large changes in NOI, because we divide that by a yield of 8%, can result in very, very sizable changes in value of an asset. Real estate is very sensitive to changes in rent because of these magnification effects, which is why when things work, they really work and everybody builds a building, and when they don't work, everybody gets out of it at the same time. If we hop along this to 35, I want to talk a bit more about financing. We were talking a little bit about financing on 33, but let's talk more about financing on 35. The issue of leverage is interesting also, that you just don't borrow money at one phase in the deal. You basically have three phases of a development deal. The first phase is buying the land. Often you can't finance the land because since the land doesn't produce any cash flow, what with the fact that, well, it's land, and there's no income, you have to come up with special ways to buy the land. Sometimes the landowner joint ventures with a new buyer because it's environmental, may not want to totally let control of the site. Sometimes they'll lend the money to the new buyer to buy it. One way or another, land acquisition has a lot of funky things going on. With environmental, you're often not just buying the site. Often the new buyer is essentially joint venturing with the old seller. They're going to work together, set up a new company that owns the land, and go move forward. As far as where you borrow money at, there are two phases: construction and permanent financing. During the construction phase, you're borrowing money to build the building. You also might be able to borrow money to do the remediation. And if you can, that's really a great thing, because basically you can borrow low-cost money, because now that the bank knows you're going to be building a building, they could actually lend you the money for the cleanup, which, of course, would be, well, a good thing.
And just so those of you who deal with this program, the EPA Revolving Loan Fund program is intended to be sort of a gap, either on existing properties where you're not taking a construction loan, or can be given at the same time as a construction loan, or can be prior to a construction loan. But that source of funds is intended to act in a similar fashion as that construction loan. And what's that beeping? Do you know?
I do not know, but I just remind everybody to mute their phones, press *6.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Josh.
Okay. So moving right along. Of course, there's a little race that goes on once you have a construction loan. You want to run from the construction financing as fast as you can to the permanent source of capital. Because when you borrow construction money, you pay high rates of interest, because it's pretty risky. I mean, you're building a building. A lot of things can go wrong. You're borrowing money at high rates of interest, and not only that, the loans are what's known as being at recourse. In other words, if a loan is a recourse loan, if you fail to pay it back, not only can the bank take the site back, but they can actually go ask you personally for the money. For example, for anyone in here who owns a house, if you own a house, I can almost guarantee you that you, when you made the mortgage, it also includes basically something saying that in the event that you can't pay off the mortgage, not only can they take the house, they can come after you personally for the shortfall, what's known as a deficiency judgment. Now, realistically, banks rarely actually execute that, because frankly, after they've taken your house, there's usually not a lot left that you have. But that's the concept. In commercial finance, however, if you, once you're done with the construction loan, when it's fully built, you can get a long-term mortgage on the site. That long-term mortgage, otherwise known as permanent financing, that's not only low interest rate note, it also means that they can't come after you personally. This is a very nice, safe place for an owner to be, right? Not only is he or she paying a low interest rate, but in addition, even if things go horribly, horribly wrong, it doesn't bankrupt the whole business. It simply means they lose the building. Not a happy thing, but not bankrupting. Slide 36 talks about where the money comes from. You have conventional money and unconventional money. Conventional money is nice, safe, secure, low interest rate money, but to get that money, you have to have a traditional deal, which means either it's clean or you have an NFA from the state agency or some sort of assurance that basically the site is now considered clean from the or controlled by the regulatory authorities. Of course, many environmental deals don't meet that criteria, so essentially you're back with unconventional financing. Unconventional has higher rates of interest, and it also means that it's at recourse. So not only do we have the impact of negative leverage, that is to say that the interest rate could be so high that you're basically better off not even using debt, you're better off using equity, but in addition, the recourse adds extra risk. And basically, if you mess it up, well, they take the building away and they come after you personally. I'm not going to define all the terms here. Suffice it to say, essentially, you have two groups, conventional, which are traditional, boring lenders, banks, insurance companies, pension funds, and then you have unconventional financing. Wealthy individuals, Wall Street funds that are set up to do this sort of stuff, all kinds of high-risk lenders, otherwise known as hard money lenders. Finally, private view of government, sector view of government incentives. Government money is very useful at the beginning when trying to quantify the problem or before you even know what's wrong and you can get anyone to lend on it. But the scale of the dollars are relatively small. Private government money is generally not effective when it tries to compete directly with the private sector. To be honest, the private sector does a wonderful job of financing real estate deals and can supply large amounts of money. So,
to be honest, the reason that mixed-use, new urbanist projects are harder to do is that there's a lot of infrastructure involved and it requires public money.
Right.
You know, you can borrow money and put up a strip mall as long as you have tenants any day of the week, but to create a new village with, you know, a town square and office and retail and housing and all the infrastructure in between, walkable streets and all that sort of thing, the public, usually the development cannot support all of that. Even in very rich projects like Georgetown Land Development is doing, where they're doing, I forget how many condos, but, you know, $750,000 condos.
Yeah.
They still need green bonds and, you know, other public finance mechanisms to help with all the infrastructure that's required.
Very true. Very true. So, there you go. That's slide 36. Slide 37 is just an amusing slide that a well-known hard money lender by the name of Kennedy Funding uses. This is an actual ad from a magazine. We find this funny, the idea that you would actually use this to advertise your services. And that people would see this ad and say, gee, that's what I'm looking for. To read the text, you need $3 million. You close in 2 weeks. Your bank already said no. Your only collateral is raw land. Call us when it gets serious. Essentially what they do is they give relatively high yield money, high interest rate money, but they'll step into the shoes if someone needs them to. That's a hard money lender. And to be honest, for a lot of environmental deals, these are the kind of people you're dealing with. High interest rate, relatively risky.
And the other, you know, like Josh said at the beginning, you would say, why would anyone borrow money from these guys? Well, if you've got a really valuable deal and you have a 90-day window to line up your financing and you're at day 75 and you can't get the bank to lend you the money on the deal, where are you going to turn? And in fact, I just looked at a project where a developer thought he had a very traditional shopping mall project, but it had a fairly big tank leak on the property, and they needed to go. They didn't go to a hard money lender; they went to fund that specializes in environmental finance. So the interest rate was higher, and in fact, in this case, they had to bring them in as a partner, as opposed to simply lending them the money. And then the developer ultimately financed that environmental development entity out of the deal.
Right, Josh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Question. What does CMBS stand for? And is mezzanine financing like a bridge loan?
CMBS, yeah, I wasn't going to define all these, but that's okay. CMBS stands for Commercial Mortgage-Backed Securities. What that means in English is basically Wall Street lends you the money, takes the mortgage that you give them, and then puts it together with a bunch of other mortgages and issues bonds. Mezzanine financing is not bridge financing. Bridge financing is short-term money to get you from point A to point B. Mezzanine could be bridge, but what mezzanine is basically, you know, if you borrow 70%, they make you a loan. If you borrow 90% of the money you need, they give you a loan, and for the last 20% you need, they say, okay, we'll lend it to you, but instead of just simply lending you the money, we want you to make us a junior partner and actually give us a percentage of the profits. The reason it's called mezzanine is the idea, if you think of floor one as being debt and floor two being equity, mezzanine, the mezzanine floor, is somewhere in between one and two. It's structured like debt, but it's legally equity, but it's structured like debt, basically.
And Josh, wasn't Sarasota financed that way? It was 70% bank,
Sarasota,
20% mezzanine. And
yeah, Credit Suisse First Boston gave us 95% of the money. 75% was a first mortgage. 20% was essentially mezzanine, and the last 5% we had to put up. So the first 70% was, you know, like 6% and 7% mortgage, something normal. The 20%, the mezzanine piece, it was lent to us at a 12% rate of interest, plus they received a percentage of the profits.
That gives you a sense of the leverage in these deals. I forget the amount of money that Silverstein put up to put up the original World Trade.
$20-30 million. That's a funky one, though, because it's a 99-year lease, so people bounce around all kinds of numbers there.
Sure, but
not a lot of money to put up, basically.
Yeah, but even Fannie Mae, in the deals it does with developers, it will loan you 75% of the equity that's required. So if you take a loan that's 70 or 80%, they will then, for a different rate, lend you the 75% of that equity that you actually need to do this deal. It's all based on track record.
Yeah, no, it's very true. To use a phrase that I was told as a child, borrow a little, get a lender, borrow a lot, get a partner. And that really sort of sums it up. If we hop along for a moment.
Do you have time for two more questions?
Sure, shoot.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Actually, there's several coming up, but tell me when to stop. It appears that private sector funding is focused on right-side-up properties. How successful, in your opinion, are government incentives to attract private investments to areas that are more risky?
I guess I should really start that question, right? I don't know. I guess I would say that they're on the right track. In all of these public sector investments, there is some form of private sector financing, and so you know, it depends on which program, and it depends on which project, but I would say that in these marginal development areas, public financing is absolutely key in, you know, keeping the restoration process going. So the issue is, how do you use that public financing to attract the private financing? So if it's tax incentives are great and towns use them all the time, developers understand them, and they help reduce the cost of leases in tough areas that are hard to lease. But infrastructure money and cleanup money money that's essentially free, even a revolving loan, if you give a revolving loan at 3% and you have to pay it back over 10 or 15 years, you know, the carrying costs of that make that money essentially free. They're extremely helpful. But we all need to understand how to use these tools better in environmental situations, I think, to actually prove that out.
Right, next question on regards to slide 37. What would drive even a quote-unquote hard money lender to turn a developer down?
If the collateral wasn't there. I mean, what basically drives a hard money lender is a hard money lender asks, am I willing to foreclose on the site? I mean, if you have an environmentally contaminated site and the site, look at it this way, at the end of the day, the lender needs to at least be able to foreclose on the site. Because if you can't foreclose on the site, you really have nothing. So if the hard money lender were to look at the site and say, you don't have your cleanup approach quantified, you don't have this in a regulatory program, there's no way that if you screwed up, I can step in and basically take control of this thing, you can't get money. That's pretty much it.
They're not lending on your credibility at that point. They're lending on the value of the asset.
Right.
So I have two more questions in the queue. Do you want to continue or?
Yeah, go ahead, and then we've got just three or four more slides and we can wrap this up.
Sure.
Scenario is a municipality purchasing or receiving contaminated property as donation from an operational firm. Ultimate property use as green space using capping. Okay, this just setting up the scenario here. We got that. Is insurance recommended for the municipality? I could read that again.
No, yeah. That's fine. I think the difficulty there is that the municipality really needs to determine if that's worth it. Because they're going to need insurance and caps. Depending on the type of cap, it may or may not last. Essentially what I assume the operating company is doing is giving up any value they might have in the property for the municipality taking over the long-term maintenance of the site. Green space can have tremendous qualitative value. But third party suits, problems with the remedy. I would definitely recommend insurance, and depending on how big a piece of property and how valuable the green space, I would talk to the operating company about funding that, because I'm not sure, I'm not an attorney, but the company giving the property may still have liability should a case be brought. I don't know. That would be for the lawyers. But yeah, I think that's a good place for environmental insurance.
Okay, how significant is government environmental liability relief to development deals?
It's key.
Yeah. By liability release, we mean like an NFA or something. I mean, there are two ways I guess I can interpret that. One is sometimes developers risk for something government can't do, where government just says, well, we promise never to sue you ever again. And obviously, that's really not going to make or break this thing because that's not realistic. But as far as getting like an NFA or something, yeah, of course. I mean, if you can't get to an end point where at some point you get a release, then why are we doing this? I mean, you'll never get anyone to want to do it ever at all. I mean,
yeah, and we're seeing that in private transactions too, where owners of companies are unwilling to sell or move forward on redevelopment unless they can have some assurance that the thing isn't going to boomerang back. And I think that's a frontier for regulatory agencies to look at. But finding ways to, in Ohio and Pennsylvania with the new programs that they have to carry the liability forward as opposed to it always reverting back to the original owner. So all of that is really key to continuing to make progress in this field. And in fact, most deals are hung on whatever the regulatory structure and endpoints that are out there. So as these deals get structured, they have right into the deal, we're going to do X, Y, and Z when you get the NFA. And permanent financing is many times tied to, the completion of the cleanup and some sort of declaration of that fact. So we should move on.
Great. Okay. So let's see here.
I would skip this and go, because we only have a few minutes, Josh, is get to the Sarasota slides. Talk about the impact of
what slide number is that?
40.
Okay, there we go. So just to sort of draw home the point, we were making a ton of money beforehand, and now we say, okay, slide 40 and 41, we play the what-if game. What if in slide 40 remediation is $2 million more and estimated to take 2 years longer? Well, you can see the remediation is now $5 million. And you can see a little bit farther down, and it's a bit small admittedly, that the carrying costs have gone up quite a bit. So now instead of making 50% overall and 25% year-to-year, we're making 25% overall and 12% year-to-year. Not great, not bad, but not great. Slide 41, we say, what if rental rate drops to $15 a foot from $18, and in addition to remediation was $2 million, and the carrying costs, and as long as we're at it, the cap rates go up. In that case, and this is very reasonable, right, because it seems to be when one thing goes wrong, they all do, right? So remediation costs more money, takes longer, that lengthens the whole process. During that lengthening period, the rental rate slips on us, and as the rental rate starts to slip, the cap rate starts to shift, because there's a perception that the market basically is starting to turn. At that point, we're now losing money, right? We're losing 12% overall. This could bankrupt someone, because basically now you've got to come out of pocket for $3 million and change. Hopefully you have that money. Otherwise, if you don't, essentially the project defaults, they take the project back, and now they come after you personally. That's the problem. It tends to be like a domino thing. It's been said in real estate that when you go bankrupt, you see it 2 years out. And there's a lot of truth to that. When it starts to go wrong, you see it coming, it happens, and it's like a tidal wave in slow motion. There's not a darn thing you can do about it.
Yeah, real estate is not a liquid investment at a certain point.
Right. Yeah. That's the idea.
So we're just going to wrap up. We only have 5 minutes. We're going to talk about cashing out. Cashing out is the ultimate or interim goal, depending on where developers are in the real estate cycle. But this is the way that real estate fortunes are made and real estate dynasties are established. So, Josh, you want to give them the once-over?
Hey, before you move on, I just want to ask that people press star 6 and mute their phones. Just some background noise.
Okay, what am I going over, Mike?
Cashing out, number 42.
Okay, just checking. Just a little confused there for a moment. So slide 42, cashing out, this is, of course, as Mike was saying, basically how dynastic wealth is built. Let's say hypothetically, and these are all new numbers, you have some project for $16.5 million. Let's just say, just focus on that bottom number on slide 42. You do a project for $16.5 million. Slide 43, let's pretend and say that the net income for this site is $2 million. So net operating income, you make $2 million a year. The $2 million divided by 8.5% is $23.5 million. In other words, You spent 16.5 to buy in. You sold it for 23.5, which means you net $7 million. Now, on one hand, you might say, well, this is pretty good. You spent 16 million. You sell it for 23. You keep 7. I'll sell. Well, is there another option?
Well, and why would you want another option? The reason you might want another option is that sale is subject to capital gains. Go ahead.
And no one likes paying taxes. So assuming we want to get out of paying taxes, and also assuming we want to sort of build wealth for the long term, maybe instead of selling for $7 million, you do what's on slide 44. You borrow, since the property makes $2 million a year, you borrow enough debt that you can support it on $1.65 million of income. Banks won't lend you a amount of money that's so large that you have to spend every dollar you make on the building, but rather most dollars. So in this case, without going through all the math, if the property could throw off 1.65, you borrow, let's say, $21 million. So now instead of selling it for 23 and change and making 7, you refinance it for 21 and change. So instead of taking $7 million subject to taxes, you take $5 million. Now the difference here is, on one hand, you make $7 million and you pay taxes. On the other hand, you take 5, tax-free, mind you, which is a wonderful thing, 5 tax-free, and meanwhile the property is still making the difference between the $2 million in income and the 1.65 of the debt, so the property is still making $350 a year. That concept of cashing out, of taking a piece of property, refinancing it, taking out money tax-free, using the tax-free money, assumedly, to buy more buildings, and still having a stream of cash flow is basically how real estate is built over the long term. The reason we're dwelling on this point is because it's really key to understanding what a developer's long-term goal is. A lot of people picture real estate developers and investors as people who buy and flip. That's a lie. People who buy and flip properties, you see this on the late night TV, guys, the buy and flip is really not the way that the majority of the industry works. The majority of the industry works by buying properties, fixing them up, holding them 5, 10, 15 years or more, refinancing them, buying more properties. It is very much a business of long-term investment. Now, admittedly, for those of you, which is pretty much everyone in here dealing with environmental, you might say, yeah, but long-term, it's only 10 years, it's not an institutional length of time, you know, it's not generational. But when you compare the industry to, say, something like, I don't know, stocks, bonds, something like that, it actually is a pretty long period of time. I mean, admittedly, as I said, it's not, say, you know, generational. But there definitely is an ownership which does care about the asset for something resembling a long term.
Well, really the two largest class of owners of real estate are REITs now. Wall Street has taken a much larger role, so there's this huge institution behind owning large classes of real estate. And then there are real estate families, you know, second, third, fourth generation of folks in this business. This is the goal of any person who wants to get a site redeveloped, is to get it into this process where it can be maintained and a constant set of cash flow available to it to resolve and control any issues that may have to do with the remedy, and of course keep the building rented and viable.
Sure.
That's it. Come to our courses. Region 1 is next week in Westford, Mass, the 18th and 19th, and Region 9 is June 12th and 13th. You can talk to Diane about that.
And thanks, Mike and Josh, and to all the participants. This audio portion and the slides will be archived on Cluin in the future, so check back with us.
Great. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Cool.